Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Why not sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources? That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
I am absolutely delighted to be joined by Joseph Weigel, a firefighter and host of the Men with Chests podcast. Joseph's also the author of a very exciting upcoming book called Planet Thulcandra, which is an exposition on the relationship between magic and science in that hideous strength. As well as finding out a little bit more about Joseph, we're also going to be hearing a paper that he presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. The title of Joseph's paper there was Dr. Dimble's Neutrals. We've touched a little bit on the idea of neutrals. Before we delve into what that is, would you, again, if you can without any spoilers, who is Dr. Dimble? Because he's the one who speaks about neutrals, isn't he?
Yeah, so Dr. Dimble is the most Lewis-like, I would say, in the story. He's like Lewis, you know, inputting himself into the tale. And he's a medieval scholar, like Lewis. And and so he is a teacher at the university, and he tutors people on, you know, his subject. And so he's one of the company at St. Anne's, and he's the guy who most often, you know, muses about things and provides his thoughts on different topics throughout the story.
And what are his neutrals, and why was it that you wanted to delve into that in a little bit more depth, Joseph?
Yeah, so there's a passage where Dimble is talking to his wife, and that Merlin has just recently been brought back in the story, and Dimble is telling his wife that there's this neutral spirit being that either still exists or used to exist, and he tells his wife that it's not an angelic being, whether good or bad. So it's not a good type of angel or a bad type of angel, which, you know, would be a devil and demon. So it's different than, you know, angelic types of beings. And so he's telling his wife, you know, about these neutrals, and he says that you even get glimpses of them in St. Paul. That was what really made me interested, because, you know, it's like, all right, Lewis likes to play with, you know, imaginary ideas sometimes that maybe he's just coming up with his great imagination. But then he has Dimble say that you even get glimpses of these neutrals in St. Paul. So I'm like, all right, what, where in Paul? Like, what are we talking about here? You know, where could this be? And along with this, I guess it'd be useful to point out that the way Dimble defines neutrals is he says that they are neutral in relation to humanity. So that's key. They're not neutral in relation to God. He is very clear that a conscious being is either obeying or disobeying God's will. So not neutral in relation to God. That's impossible, is what Dimble's saying. But neutral in relation to humanity. Basically, they're minding their own business in relation to humanity. Okay, so then I wanted to know, all right, where in St. Paul are mm-hmm. Dimble's neutrals. In order to narrow, you know, the options, you have to first kick out all the angelic beings in Paul, because Dimble is saying these are not angelic beings of any sort, whether good or bad. So that limits your scope big time. So with all those beings removed, and this includes, just to give, you know, like a prominent example, the Ephesians 6 passage where Paul's writing about principalities and powers, and depending on your translation, you know, the different words that come across in English, all these Greek words refer to types of angelic beings. So, you know, all these things are kicked out of the options. So the word that I identified as being the most likely candidate is the Greek word stoicheia. And this is a word that appears 7 times in the New Testament. Twice it's in 2 Peter. So those are kicked out because, you know, that's not Paul. Once in Hebrews, which may be Paul, maybe not. But it actually doesn't matter, because in Hebrews, the use of stoicheia is clearly not what Dimble's talking about. And then it's used twice in Galatians and twice in Colossians. Okay, so there's our options. Now, stoicheia itself is a Greek word that has multiple meanings. And the meaning, you know, is determined on the context. So the Hebrews passage that I said doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because the use of stoicheia there is talking about the fundamentals or ABCs of a particular discipline. So this is one definition of stoicheia, and that's not what Dimble's talking about. Another definition of stoicheia is some sort of rational spirit being. So that sounds more like what Dimble might be talking about. But then the third definition of stoicheia is the elements, the four elements. So earth, air, fire, water. Okay, so with that third definition in mind, when you look at the options from Paul of the use of stoicheia and what Dimble would likely have in mind, we have to take into account that Lewis was very influenced by Barfield's theory of, as he calls it in That His Strength, ancient unities. And this was this idea that for the ancient peoples, like Barfield uses the example of pneuma, and then in the New Testament, that, you know, okay, it means wind, but it also means spirit. And Barfield saying, well, no, it meant both at the same time. You couldn't sequester these definitions out for the ancient person. That's not how they viewed the world. They, for them, it was unified, you know, ancient unities. It is the theory of semantic unity for Barfield. So the elements, the four elements in the ancient world, they're also, stoicheia is the Greek word here, right? It also would entail the idea of there being spirit beings associated with those elements. So it's not just a physical thing, it's also spiritual in some way. And when you look at, say, like the Latin Vulgate, which translates stoicheia in the Colossians passages as, let's see, elementa mundi, and then elementis hujus mundi. These both mean elementals of the world. So both the physical elements and also the attachment of the spiritual entities with these elements. That's the idea. If you actually look at the English word element and trace its etymology back, it goes back through the Latin elementum or elementa to the Greek word stoicheia. So you can track how this etymology develops. All right. So, and by the way, Barfield and his theory of ancient semantic unities, that's not just unique to like Barfield and the Inklings. In more recent times, the Bible scholar Michael Heiser, he talks specifically about stoicheia in these usages in Colossians, and points out that you can't take the supernatural out of this word. This is something that for the ancients, they attach that, just like what Barfield was saying. All right, so Lewis, in this letter to Dom Bede Griffiths, he writes about the use of stoicheia by Paul in Galatians. And he's explained to Griffiths that, you know, these Bible scholars, they dispute what stoicheia means. You know, some saying it means these ABCs, the fundamentals of the Jewish law. Others are saying, well, it means this spiritual entity that's connected with the elements. And Lewis is saying, well, it means both. Like, you know, the word can't be separated out. It means all these things at once. And the context will be key for helping you decipher exactly what is meant by it. So Lewis, he knew this word intimately as basically a native Greek reader, you know, because he would read in the original Greek. So I think that the most likely case is that Lewis is having Dimble refer to St. Paul, and he's thinking of, I think, Colossians is the most likely case because of the context of Colossians. So in Colossians, you have Paul warning the new Christians at Colossae about this heresy that's sprung up there. And it's basically this form of Jewish mysticism where they are interested in the cult or worship of angels, it's called. And then they're interested in this stoicheia is the word that's used. And Paul's warning them, do not become enslaved to the stoicheia or elementals of the world. So the context of Colossians is this spiritual interest that the people are demonstrating. And Paul's warning them, hey, the fullness of deity dwells bodily in Christ. That's kind of the key point that he contrasts with all their obsession with these angels and then possibly these stoicheia as well. So I think, and the way Dimble phrases this, he says one gets glimpses of this neutral population in St. Paul. And I think that fits with the Colossians context and passage, because it's not something that's really fleshed out and explained there at all. So I could see how Lewis is thinking, like, yeah, you get glimpses, you know, it's just glimpses. Maybe this is a thing, maybe not, you know, it's just glimpses. So that's my best attempt to identify what Lewis has in mind when he has Dimble reference St. Paul as giving glimpses of this population of neutral spirit beings. I think it's the stoicheia in Colossians. And I think the way that we can then think about that using words that we better understand would be elementals would be a great one. Maybe if you're familiar with discarded image, longiwi is word Lewis uses there, which then he says is best translated into English as fairies. And then we have to go into the options that Lewis gives for understanding what the fairies are. But that would be my case of what I think Lewis is drawing on from Paul.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
Have you ever found yourself wondering if it's still possible to have civil conversations in today's culture wars? That's exactly why we want to send you a brand new and exclusive booklet called Arguing for the Sake of Heaven, a look at the life and legacy of Charlie Kirk. This compelling resource reflects on Charlie's legacy and the controversies he sparked, but more importantly, it explores how we can recover the art of disagreeing agreeably. In a polarized world, how do we defend free speech, speak the truth in love, and pursue truth without fear? I believe this is a resource that every thoughtful Christian should have. And right now, it's our special thanks to you for your gift to Premier Insight. Your support helps ensure that content like this podcast and so many others continue reaching people who are searching for wisdom, truth, and hope. So I encourage you to give today by visiting premierinsight.org/cslewis. That's premierinsight.org/cslewis to receive your copy today. Now let's get back to today's episode.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. So would you say then that Lewis believes in things like fairies or perhaps ghosts, these neutrals, but not super demonic, not super angelic? Would you say that it's fair to say that Lewis believes in these creatures?
Yeah, well, certainly, I guess we have to, you know, be clear about our terms ghost for sure, because ghost is, as he would define it. And I think this, I mean, if you look it up, just the common definition, it's a disembodied soul. And, you know, that's what happens to humans after death until they await the resurrection. So ghost, without a doubt. And then all the different types of angels, I would say Lewis, without a doubt as well. The neutrals, I think I would lean towards probably, and that's the way I phrase it, like in my paper. I'm not saying certainly Lewis did, but when I look at the full scope of his work and what he says about these beings, whether he uses the term longiwi or fairies or in this case neutrals, and by the way, I guess I should note Dymble mentions other terms that help us narrow the scope. When I define all these things in the chapter on this, I explore these other terms. He uses, see, elves, water people, fate, which is Italian for fairies. He uses longiwi. So I think Lewis, I would say probably, very slightly, maybe another like 60-40, thinks that these neutrals exist, but maybe that he thought that they exist, previously, in a historical time before, and that they've been slowly been pushed to not being neutral in relation to humanity because of the incarnation. So that's a slight twist that I could see that is a likely possibility, that he thought that there were more neutrals, and now if there are any, maybe they're not, but there'd be a lot less because of the differences that the incarnation makes. And we get hints of this in That Hideous Strength when Dymble, you know, is talking to his wife, and it's unclear whether Dymble himself thinks that there are any neutrals left, or if this is something that was completely only in the past.
Yeah, he says there used to be neutrals, doesn't he? That's one of his lines. I mean, yeah. Do you think any of Lewis's contemporaries think that the existence of neutrals was plausible?
Yeah, well, this is something that I do in the text. I quote Tolkien's On Fairy Stories, because Tolkien has this interesting line where he says, if elves exist, then they are not concerned with us, which is to say they're neutrals. You know, they're minding their own business. And elves is the word used for what then became fairies. I think it was like the 16th century where that transition happened. So the common word for these same type of beings, say back in, you know, 14th century, was elves, and then it transitions to fairies. So Dymble uses elves in, or does he use elves? I'm trying to remember if he does or not. He uses dwarfs. I think he does use elves. It's irrelevant even if he doesn't, because Lewis uses it in a discarded image. But yeah, Tolkien, I think, would be a case of somebody who at least is, you know, like I said with Lewis, I wouldn't say he's for sure, you know, saying there are these things, but he's not closing the door for there being such things.
And do you think there's an argument to be made for the Bible in general? Is there anywhere else in the Bible where there's a potential speak of neutral beings as opposed to good or bad?
Yeah, well, even in the passage from Paul that I'm looking at with Stoicheia, the thing is, it's described by Paul in a negative way. So it's like, all right, well, how could this actually be neutral? You know, because Paul's warning them, don't mess with these things. But the thing is, with the way the letter is written, I don't think we can rule out the idea that they are neutral until they're provoked. And so it's at least plausible when you look at Colossians to say that, well, they were neutral until you went and messed with them. And as soon as you mess with them, it's a detriment to yourself. So there is no way that they can be interacted with and it be a positive good for you. And that's what we see with the Merlin character, where he's described as withered, you know, for instance, because of his interaction with these things. Dimble compares it to Abraham's polygamy and how that withered Abraham. And this is something similar for Merlin, that it withered him. So I think it's at least plausible when I look at Stoicheia to say that, okay, maybe they're neutral until you go provoking them. Maybe not, but it's at least an option. I didn't really look at any other options with, say, like the Old Testament. The Old Testament would provide, I think, other places where we could possibly find something, but because Dimble is just referencing Paul, I narrowed to just that.
Joseph, given the advancements in technology that would have potentially seemed magical in Lewis's time, how might he view the relationship between science and magic today, do you think? I suppose an example of that might be artificial intelligence, which potentially seems very magical, but is just really clever science.
Yeah, well, this is one of the big warnings, I think, from That Hideous Strength. He, you know, he has the top two guys in the Nice, Wither and Frost, themselves, I make the case that Lewis thinks of them as magicians, because they are contacting spiritual beings. In this case, it's the bad ones. So they're practitioners of Gaia, and they're using it to try and command, to try and have more power over the world. And one of the ways in which this is done is to use the technological advancements that are represented by Philostrato's ability to revivify Aucassin's physical functioning head. All right, so he revivifies his head, and this is done through technology. And this is the host, or the avenue, by which then Frost and Wither are able to communicate with these macrobes. So in that example, you have technology used in order to produce a path to communication with these beings. And this is all done under the goal of trying to create the immortal God-man, is how I phrase it. And this is eerily similar to things we see with artificial intelligence today, where it's believed by some that we're going to be able to basically make human consciousness immortal somehow. And Lewis's warning, I think, is there's a couple warnings. One of the points I make is this actually may produce the incarnation of devils, is one of the options I think Lewis is warning of, because that's actually what happens with Aucassin's head. Philostrato thinks he's revivifying Aucassin's head and therefore Aucassin's consciousness. And Philostrato is described multiple times in the story as a dupe. He's a fool. Frost even tries to explain to him, like, hey, you idiot, no. this is not Aucassin's mind that we're talking with. This is the macrobes. And it says that Philostrato just can't get it. You know, he can't comprehend that. So what ends up happening is the revivification of Aucassin's head brings about the actual incarnation, you know, the infleshing of devils. that's the more extreme thing that Lewis may be warning of. The less extreme, but still very terrifying and more, probably more realistic case, I think Lewis is making, is that this attempt to create immortal humanity by preserving consciousness is a deception of devils. And the great example, I think, of looking at a biblical text and understanding this idea is, and I explain this in the book, you have at the end of chapter 9, Ransom talking, he's like musing in his mind about what's happened and what this means, because they've just discovered that Alcasan, via one of Jane's dreams, they've just discovered that Alcasan's head has been revivified. And so now they're like, all right, the bad guys have this talking head. And so he's reflecting on what this means. And one of the things he says is that if humanity, by their own power of technology, has now acquired, you know, power so great that they are able to cast off the limitation that God mercifully imposed upon us as a result of the fall, then basically hell will follow. So the limitation God imposed upon us as a result of the fall that Ransom describes as being a mercy is man is kicked out of the garden and they're not given access to the tree of life. So they're not able to achieve immortality. So that's a mercy is what Ransom is saying. Well, my point is if the serpent wanted us to bite from the first tree, well, now the logical next step is, okay, bite from the second tree. Achieve immortality through your own technological power. And I think Lewis is saying this is a deception of devils. They wanted us to bite from the first one. Now they want us to take a bite from the second one, the tree of life.
Joseph, you touched on how Lewis has influenced your ideas around the supernatural, but do you feel like he's influenced your ideas on science and magic at all?
Well, I mean, certainly magic was something I'd not really thought about much at all until reading Lewis. So yeah, absolutely. And then with science, more of understanding exactly what is science and what its limits are. Because Lewis is not not somebody who's attacking science. He values science, but he recognizes that it has limits and it needs to understand those limits and basically stay within its lane. So like a guy like Hengist and That Hideous Strength is an example of somebody who's a genuine scientist. And he's not interested in being a part of the NICE because he realizes that, hey, they're not actually a Institute of Coordinated Experiments. They're this institute that's a political conspiracy is how he describes it. So recognizing what it is that science does and not trying to then take from that and claim things that are science that are in fact philosophy, you know, things that are metaphysics. That's something that science, just by its very definition, doesn't do. So recognizing exactly what science is something that I think Lewis has helped me to clearly see.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @PremierUnbelievableFE, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @PremierUnbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @Premier.Unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.